Well, I know people who love to run multiple times a week, but there is no more regular runner than John Sutherland. Yesterday morning, the California resident logged his 16,438th consecutive day of running at least 1 mile, a new U.S. record. This, according to a story in the Washington Post, that is 45 years and 2 days. 190,000 miles. John Sutherland is a 63-year-old music journalist, record producer, and metalhead. That's what keeps him going. He's from Sherman Oaks, California. He has run despite 10 broken bones, 2 knee surgeries, unbelievable, and more late-night metal concerts than he could possibly count. He says, I do everything except go to the party because I like to get up and run. And when he was asked when the streak might stop, he quoted James Hetfield of Metallica with a line I can't repeat here. It would suggest that he intends to keep going. I'll just paraphrase it like that. Welcome to Current State. Later on this hour, Senator Randy Richardville joins us to talk about Michigan's new minimum wage law. Also, Lansing's homeless angels try to connect our area's homeless people with services. That's on the way on Neighbors in Action here on WKAR's Current State. At the top of our program, studying the final frontier of space got a little easier this month. On May 5th, a group of scientists launched an online simulator that allows users to explore our galaxy in incredibly accurate detail. It covers a span of billions of years. But what's the most innovative part of this new project? Anyone can use it, whether you're getting your doctorate in astrophysics or you're just a curious web surfer. This project and many others are part of a movement to make scientific research and data open to use and scrutiny by scientists as well as the general public. It's a movement called Open Science, and it attempts to remove the traditionally restrictive ways in which scientific research is both conducted and shared. With us today to speak more about open science and its potential for scientific research, Dr. Ian Dworkin from MSU's Department of Zoology. An associate professor at MSU, Ian participated in a panel last fall about open science and has shared his views regarding the movement openly in his blog. Welcome, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Well, thank you for having me on Current State.
Tell us a little bit more how you would describe the open science movement to a non-scientist. You run into somebody at a party and you say, what is open science? How do you describe it?
It's a great question. So fundamentally, open science is exactly as you describe it. We're trying to make all aspects of what we do open to everybody, whether that is the sort of final summary that we do when we publish papers, so we, you know, summarize things in our manuscripts, or it's the actual data that we generate, the raw data and other forms of the data, and how we actually analyze that data. All of these things have gotten increasingly complex, but at the same time, we now have, through the internet, an ability to store and disseminate that very easily. And so the idea is to make everything we do very easy for other scientists and for members of the public to access, to make comments on it, to ask questions, and to just free it up to basically achieve the goals of science that have been set for the last 400 years of making this an open endeavor for all of society.
And what's the potential impact of this movement?
I think there's a couple of really important potentials. One, for scientists, is to make scientific research happen faster. And the reason that might happen is because with science, in the traditional methods that science has worked by, both the publication of our work, but also the data, to get it from one person to another, it used to be you'd either have to mail it or you'd go and have to visit another lab somewhere else, potentially in the world. It could be on the other side of the world to access it. Now with this, if somebody has some questions that they want to address and maybe you've done some experimental work that may help them address that, if that data is already available, they may be able to move forward very quickly. So from the point of view of scientists, it may make our progress faster and potentially more efficient.
Continue, please.
For the more general public, I think it's will help, in particular now where I think there's still concerns about between the public and the scientists about sort of communication. How well do we communicate with the public about what we do, how we get there? Often our work is funded by the public through agencies like the National Science Foundation or National Institutes of Health. People honestly want to know what we're doing with this money that they're supporting us with. And this provides a way of saying, hey, this is what we do. This is how we do it. And if you want to know more, you can be a lay member of the public, mm-hmm. but still, if you're interested, find out and work with that data.
So it's more connectivity.
Absolutely.
Due to the internet. How have you been involved, Ian?
So I got involved in a couple of ways. So when I did my own research for my PhD many years ago, I was in a very small lab. And so we actually had to rely on many other researchers to help us with resources. And so from fairly early on, I was in a culture of we would support other people whenever we produced something that could help them, and they would help us. More generally, when I moved here to East Lansing and to Michigan State University, my work has become very computational. And so I spend a lot of time not only people in my lab generating lots of data of all sorts and often very large data sets, but we also have complicated ways that we try to analyze this data. And many other scientists have asked for this data, and so I had to figure out ways that was easy to disseminate this. And because of that, I started saying, okay, what's the most efficient ways to do that and to get this to other people? And so over the last few years, I've been getting very involved with the open science movement to understand in a practical sense, how best to do it. What are the best practices?
We're talking about the open science movement with Dr. Ian Dworkin. Ian's an MSU associate professor in the Department of Zoology. Are there sectors within the scientific community where open science has gained particular traction?
Yeah, so there's a couple of very important ones. Physics has been a very open discipline for a very long time. This is not my own discipline. And that's often because they have very, very large projects that they're doing. And so there's very large groups of people working on it. And whether it's the way that they publish their manuscripts and make them available or actual sharing of data itself and analysis, that's always been a fairly open discipline. In biology, and in my particular area, which is in genetics, certain aspects of it have really moved to that, and part of this has been mandated by the institutes in the federal government that fund much of our work, that basically say, we know you're producing lots of data, and it's expensive to generate, so we want to make sure everybody gets the biggest bang for the buck. And so set up public repositories for these data, basically places, once we generate it, here's where the data goes, these are the ways you should reproduce it, so there's sort of a generic format, so anybody who wants to use it can go and look at it and know what everything means and use that. And so
it doesn't sound like it's of a whole lot of value to the lay public. It's really, at least with that example, it sounds as if it has more relevance to your fellow scientists.
That's absolutely correct. Where it becomes much more interesting to the public is at two levels. One, obviously, there are many areas where the public and scientists interface, whether it's issues of climate change or issues of evolutionary biology, where perhaps there are still controversies. And in those particular areas, this provides a great venue to say, you know, if somebody's skeptical of the scientific endeavors that we do, this provides a venue of saying, well, this is the actual data, and you can see what we've done, and here's how we've analyzed it. And so that's a one level. And of course, that still might require some level of expertise. But the other level at which open science really interacts with the public is something called citizen science, which is the idea of integrating the public into scientific projects. And this is often done with people who study species of birds, and whether they're disappearing, conservation. So people look at those sorts of they integrate public people who may be enjoying going birding for their own purposes, but then they help them collect data. And that data itself is public so that the public can sort of say, hey, not only did I help generate it, but I can go look at it and maybe even use it to figure out where, if I want to see species, you know, a particular bird, where to go find it, or something like that.
Is there resistance to the open science movement?
There is a little bit of resistance. I would say that the vast majority of scientists are completely open to the idea. Where the concerns come in, there's a few. One is scientists in recent years have undergone additional levels of sort of bureaucracy. We have a lot more forms to fill out and things like that. And so for some people, this feels like just one more thing that they have to do to get on with their science. And so they feel like it distracts from them from their actual science. I think as we've become more efficient at figuring out ways of disseminating our data and making a sort of a more clear path forward, that's becoming less of an issue. Probably the most substantial issue that is repeated among scientists, the broadest concern is, well, what if somebody misuses that data? So climate change scientists may be concerned if that data gets misused by climate change deniers about something like that. In some sense, having that as an open discussion is possibly useful as well, although those concerns are quite real.
In your blog, you say that you're not sure if you're willing to be a martyr with regard to your full participation in open science. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question. So that directly has to do with a certain aspect of the open science movement, which is about open access publishing. So until quite recently, most of the journals that we published in were subscription-based. So that means that private companies publish our papers and end up getting the copyrights for those papers, even though we've done the scientific research and the public has paid usually for that scientific research. Most of the very prestigious journals in sciences are of this nature. But there's been a big movement to make what's called open access journals where anybody can read it. So they are open to everybody and the funding mechanism for them isn't based on library subscriptions. So only the most wealthy universities and members of those universities can see it, but anybody can see these. And some of these journals have not, the open access journals, some of them have become quite prestigious themselves, but many are still in the scientific community. Scientists can be a little, because of the skeptical nature, can be conservative about some aspects of change, and particularly about scholarly communication. And so it's been slow to be accepted in some areas. And so, including my area, some open access journals are widely regarded, but other ones are not.
So how much impact could open science have on the status quo in higher education? Are you suggesting that could be pretty dramatic?
I think it can be. In a couple of very interesting ways. One, obviously, there's many universities. Michigan State here in East Lansing is quite a well-off, large university, and we have many resources. But there's many universities, not just in the United States, but across the world, which don't have the kinds of resources. And this opens up for those teachers, for the professors at these different institutions, or for high school teachers, for that matter, access to these journals. One of the other really important areas is for medical research. So patients who have often, particularly for rare diseases where there's not a lot of information to go on, there's rarely summaries that their doctors can provide for them about their diseases, and they do have to interact with that literature, the scientific literature. And having this for free instead of having to pay $20 or $30 for every scientific article to understand something about their condition may be helpful. And that's an important area, I think, and is already quite widely used.
One thing that jumps out at me is how territorial some people will always be about their research. I would think there's some percentage of scientists who take, who have worked very hard at learning what they've learned, who might, for that very reason, be less willing to share it with the public.
Absolutely, Mark. So there is still a group of scientists, for sure, and they're fairly active if you read scientific blogs, who say, well, it's taken me a really long time to collect this data, and it's not to use this data or to use how I've developed the way I do my analysis. I want to keep doing it, and I want to make sure I have first dibs, basically, at producing new scientific research from that, and so are concerned about that. And I think there's some legitimate concern for some people about that, especially at smaller institutions, at smaller schools. But in general, once you are publishing your data with respect to one question, you're answering one question and publishing one paper, then that data should be made available. In fact, that idea has been out there for a very long time, and most journals require it. The other thing that might happen, and which is, most scientists don't want to say this publicly, but of course it's always a concern, is we're people, we make mistakes. Scientists, we recognize that we make mistakes. And as both the experiments that we do and the analyses that we do get more complicated, the possibility of making mistakes becomes more likely, right? And you know, we try to be conscientious and check for them, but always people are worried about, well, what if somebody finds a mistake?
Exactly, yeah. Ian Dworkin is an MSU associate professor in the Department of Zoology. We have been talking about the open science movement. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks for joining us today. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Hourly salaries of Michigan's lowest paid workers will go up on September 1st. That's on the heels of a measure signed into law last evening by Governor Rick Snyder. Whether to raise the state's minimum wage has been one of the most debated issues so far in 2014, and our next guest has been closely involved to discuss that and other matters, including his comprehensive road funding measure. We welcome Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville to Current State. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Well, thank you for having me this morning.
So the Senate version of a minimum wage hike prevailed after some back and forth yesterday. Are you more satisfied, more dissatisfied? What?
Well, more satisfied. I think that, you know, we have a bicameral government here in Michigan because representatives from the House as well as from the Senate have things to contribute. And I think the biggest thing that we got back from the House yesterday was the five-year rolling average on the indexing, CPI indexing, because, you know, the spikes that businesses might have to undergo will be smoothed out this way, and it'll be easier planning and less ups and downs. So I think that was a valuable piece of the overall package.
What is your understanding of the future of the Raise Michigan ballot proposal here right now? Supporters told us they still want the 10-10 an hour proposal before voters in November. Are you preparing for that or not?
Well, you know, there's nothing much to prepare for. What we did yesterday was repeal the existing law on minimum wage, the existing minimum wage statute, and replaced it with another one. So their ballot initiative really doesn't address a piece of law anymore that's valid.
There's nothing they could do through the courts, though?
Well, it's possible they could, but here's the problem. That language that they had was sloppy. It was really not very well thought out or explained to people that signed those petitions. You had a lot of out-of-state money coming into Michigan and then paid volunteers. These aren't even people that necessarily believe in what they were circulating. They couldn't explain the language going around getting signatures. And if you just ask a simple question, do you think our lowest paid workers should get paid more? Certainly a vast majority of the people say, yeah, I think they should. But they didn't take into account the tourism industry. They didn't take into account tip wages that waiters and waitresses get. They didn't take into consideration what happens if the economy goes bad. So it was really poorly written and poorly explained to the voters. So when we saw that the potential was there for that kind of legislation to go into play, we, who were elected by a democratic process, not paid by out-of-state people, took the issue on, negotiated with the Democrats on both sides, got a majority of votes from Democrats and Republicans. And I think what you saw is what people have been clamoring for all around the state and around the country. Why don't you stop the political stuff and sit down and work things out together? And that's what you saw, is a bipartisan package that addressed the minimum wage issue and also way into the future by indexing it. Let me explain that. The last time the minimum wage was addressed was some 7-8 years ago. And the reason that it needed to be addressed and that so many people were supportive of the ballot initiative is because it had been neglected for that number of years. So what we did is, instead of just putting it down for a certain period of time and then having it stay the same forever, we took the Consumer Price Index for the Midwest region and said, in the future, we will increase the minimum wage to keep up with the cost of living in this area. So I think we more responsibly addressed this than what the ballot initiative did.
Do you expect more Democratic support for your road funding proposal as a result of this minimum wage law?
No, I think that both are being treated separately. And we've got a pretty good, I think we finished this issue completely now. It's signed into law, and I hope we can move forward.
Representative Grimal commented yesterday to MERS that he thought this opens the door for more conversations regarding road funding.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think what happened is you saw that Republicans and Democrats can work together better than what we have in the past, and this being such a great example of that, that now we have another example where we may need to do that. And so we've had those conversations going back over a year, actually, and now I think we're ready to go with a proposal that that addresses these the roads that we have in Michigan.
Indeed. You last week, it appears you went where very few people were willing to go with a measure that a lot of people described as bold. It aims at raising $1.5 to $1.6 billion a year to repair and maintain Michigan roads. Talk to us, please, about the response to your proposal so far and what you're hearing.
Well, these roads have been neglected for 17 years, and it's partly because of the same thing I talked about with minimum wage. There was no indexing for the cost of materials and the cost of building roads. So 19 cents a gallon in 1997 is considerably different what it can buy in 2014. So we're going to try and fix a problem that's pretty close to two decades old.
What has Speaker Bolger said to you about this? What's his response been?
He's willing to be open-minded and put a vote up in front of both caucuses. I think you're going to find bipartisan support. You know, I'm term limited now, so I don't have to go back and run for an office. But I will tell you what, if I was, I would not want to go back and tell my people after this winter that I did nothing to fix the roads. And I would not tell them that I put more Band-Aids on the roads. I think they're tired of that.
We have
to fix the structural problem, and there is a structural problem in Michigan.
Again, we're talking with Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville here on WKAR's Current State. It was reported that the road funding measure could be opened up to debate this week. Where is it right now? Were you sidetracked by the minimum wage too much to get to this, or have you started talking about it?
No, not at all. I think what you mentioned before, we wanted to show the Democrats and the House members that we could work together to get a big issue done like minimum wage, and let's tackle them, you know, one piece at a time. I introduced the substitutes last week, and we will have a formal caucus this morning where I'll talk to the 25 other Republicans in the Senate about where they are on it.
This would apparently mean another 25 cents or so to the price of a gallon of gas. Some cynics have responded this means a whole lot more people driving to Ohio and Indiana to buy their gas. What's your response to that?
My response is this could be a two-step process. I mentioned that there is a structural problem. Most people don't know that at the pump, when you fill up your tank with gasoline, there is a sales tax on that gasoline. That sales tax does not go to the roads. It's 6%. So on a $3 gallon of gasoline, you're talking about 18 cents just there alone. The gas tax is 19 cents. So the total amount that you'd be paying in that case for Michigan taxes is 37 cents. And half of that goes to the roads, the other half doesn't. That's the structural problem I talked about.
We're one of only four states, apparently, where that greater percentage of the sales tax on gasoline doesn't go to roads.
Exactly, and that's the structural problem that we'll have to get to. But we won't be able to do that without amending the Constitution, because sales tax today, constitutionally, the money goes, most of it goes to schools, the rest of it goes to local governments and the general fund. So we can't just change that here without a two-thirds vote plus a vote of the people. So what we're doing here is saying we were planning to extend over a four-year period of time, an increase in gasoline taxes at the pump. During that time, I hope the legislature addresses that problem, what I call a structural problem of charging that much sales tax on gasoline that doesn't go to the roads. Now, your taxes will not go up 24, 40, whatever cents there that people are reporting. This doesn't go into effect until next year. But what it will allow is for people to the road companies and the Michigan Department of Transportation to bond against those future dollars and get started on road projects. And on a $3 a gallon of gasoline on January 1st next year, the gas tax would go up 6 cents, not 40.
I definitely have to ask you in the time remaining about the EAA. You commented over a month ago that it's time to fish or cut bait on the Education Achievement Authority expansion here in Michigan. Has the Senate moved on, or is this proposal still being debated?
It's still being debated. I'm not going to go home for the summer until we get one more shot at it. I am within a vote or two of having it passed, and we're talking about the 50 worst performing school buildings in the state of Michigan, where not a single student, not one student, is proficient at math. We're only talking about those that are failing at the worst level. And if we don't do something, I think we're not living up to the responsibilities we've been given.
Republican Senator Randy Richardville is the Senate Majority Leader here in the state of Michigan. Many thanks, Senator.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me this morning.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Anyone who ever uses a computer, and that's an awful lot of us in this world, gets hit now and then with email spam or the occasional computer virus. Many are just minor hassles that try to derail our plans, but some do cause significant damage. Now, imagine how often large companies and government agencies get hacked by those seeking to inflict harm. To address this, the state of Michigan is creating an all-volunteer defense team, the Cyber Civilian Corps. I spoke with Dan Lohrman, Michigan's Chief Security Officer with the State Department of Technology Management and Budget. I also talked with Raj Patel. He's an information technology consulting partner with the certified public accounting company Plant Moran. I first asked Dan Lohrman what the Cyber Civilian Corps is and what led to its creation.
The governor felt like this was really important to have a cyber corps, which is a rapid response team that can respond to emergencies should the state need to have additional help in a cyber emergency, much like you might think about a volunteer fire department, you know, available hands that can help the state. Also, we have the DCH has a volunteer registry for health areas. And so the idea that if you need additional resources in a cyber emergency, these individuals are experts who can help us respond to those emergencies.
What threats does Michigan currently face to its cybersecurity? What types of breaches are you looking at now?
Well, we certainly get attacked each and every day. So we've had over 500,000 times a day different people are trying to get into our systems, and many of those are automated attacks. So we certainly have, whether it be people trying to get into databases, break into websites, and get information. So that's happening each and every day. We have people trying to break into our systems. So there's a wide variety of ways this happens, people trying to send us emails, links that could lead to people sending information that state employees giving information around their sensitive information or access credentials, or it could be people just trying to break into our networks and find holes in our cyber defense.
Raj Patel, what about a commercial business like Plant Moran? What kind of threats do you face?
We face similar threats where hackers are trying to see what if our systems are vulnerable. But we also help a number of our clients with their cybersecurity, and it's everything from somebody just trying to play around with the network to somebody actually hijacking bank account information and wiring money out.
What entities are most often targeted? Is it government? Are they commercial businesses? Are they private citizens? Dan?
Well, it's really anything that the hackers or bad guys think can get them money. So, it's certainly government has a lot of sensitive data. So we have, you know, whether it be social security numbers, credit card numbers, we have a lot of data that citizens give to the state around their driver's license information and those kinds of things. So, but also certainly banks are targeted, certainly financial institutions, but it could also be health records, could be criminal justice records. So really it's a wide range, and it's really an economic aspect to people trying to get that sensitive data.
Raj, what are the costs of your investment in cybersecurity at Plant Moran?
It's difficult to measure the cost because when you look at the cost of cybersecurity preparedness, we do user awareness training. We make sure all of our equipment's protected, so laptops are encrypted. We make sure that we provide secure portals for our clients when we share data with us, that it's encrypted and it's protected, and the access is controlled. We do independent security testing to make sure that our systems are strong. We do intrusion detection, make sure that no one's trying to break into a network. So I think costs are high, and they're spread out also.
Do you invest a lot of human resources in this effort at Plant Moran?
Absolutely, both for Plant Moran as our own internal systems. But we also have a number of resources that work with a number of Michigan-based companies in helping them assess their security as well as just cybersecurity prevention programs.
We're talking with Dan Lohrman, Michigan Chief Security Officer, and Raj Patel, who's Information Technology Consulting Partner at Plant Moran. They are both involved in Michigan's launch of the Cyber Civilian Corps, which is gathering steam as we speak. Dan Lohrman, how does the state of Michigan protect itself from cyber attack now, and how will the Cyber Civilian Corps improve on that?
So the state has a active team that really is watching our network 724-365 and our Security Operations Center. So we have a wide variety of defenses. We use a defense in depth model. A lot of our systems have built-in two-factor authentication to access the systems. We have intrusion detection systems, intrusion prevention systems. So we have a wide variety of defenses and cyber experts. So we believe the state is the national leader in this space. But should there be an emergency, cyber emergency the governor declares, just like there might be for fires, floods, tornadoes, those kinds of things, if the governor declared a state of emergency because of a cyber attack, and there was a need for additional expertise within one specific field, the Cyber Civilian Corps could be activated to help us with that specific skill set that we need in that cyber emergency.
How far into selecting all the members of the CCC, the Cyber Civilian Corps, are you?
Yeah, so we're now piloting with 10 to 15 individuals who, like Raj Patel, have stepped forward and been proactive and asked to be a part of that initial group. We're running background checks, and we're really putting together the processes and the testing. And it's going to grow to around 50 later this year. And we're really making that available to anyone in the public who thinks they're interested in volunteering, who have the skill sets. They can go to our website, and they can actually do an assessment right now. And they can, on July the 1st, they'll be actually able to sign up and be assessed by our team to determine if they can be in the Cyber Civilian Corps.
And congratulations to you, Raj, for being selected to be a part of this. Why are you interested in this role?
Yes, so for me, of course, it's my civic duty, obviously, to work with the state, its citizens, and its businesses in helping protect from cybersecurity. But it also helps me because I work side by side with some of the top cybersecurity specialists. You know, I can peer with them, collaborate with them, learn from them. And you know, so again, you're learning from the best. There'll be training provided. There'll be training tabletop exercises. So I think it's personal learning for me. It also helps me with my civic duties, as well as long-term, you know, helps me serve our clients better when it comes to cybersecurity.
Dan, tell us more about the Michigan Cyber Range. This is likened to a live fire shooting range for law enforcement, and this is going to be a big part of the Corps' training regimen. What is it? How will it work?
Yeah, so a cyber range is very similar. You might think about a gun range where people obviously shoot bullets and test things. And I was in, from Maryland. We had Aberdeen Proving Grounds. We tested. They tested tanks and things like that. But cyber range is for attack, defend in cyberspace. So the ability to actually train individuals, there's a lot of courses available. You can go to merit.edu/cyber range, which is their website, learn all about the different courses that are available. But also we can do research and test and evaluation. We call it cyber exercises, where our teams can actually do a variety of different types of tabletop and exercise to attack and defend different networks and learn how to be prepared for cyber attacks and actually to defend their networks in real life.
How will you know when a computer breach rises to the level of being addressed by the civilian cyber corps?
Yeah, so ultimately there'll be a declared emergency by the governor, just like there would be to activate other types of State Emergency Operations Center type emergency. So the cyber corps would be activated if Michigan State Police determined that we had a statewide emergency. The governor's team has a wide variety of factors that lead to that, but it would be, need to be a major emergency, and we would then have the resources from the Michigan Cyber Corps available to us to help in that emergency.
Raj Patel, any firsthand experience with the cyber range yet?
When we were initially setting it up and seeing the cyber exercises, the war room, that was really impressive to see that. Seeing some of the students work in there and getting real live experience was very impressive to see.
Dan, how is this project funded?
There's a budget that we have within the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget to actually work with the private, public-private partnerships around this issue. So it is state cyber defense dollars that we have as part of our core mission to really defend state networks. And we believe this is really a leading-edge project, but a project that will be emulated around the country as we've seen in the past.
How will the Cyber Civilian Corps be accountable to the public? Will it be sufficiently transparent?
Absolutely. We will have a team ultimately responsible to the director of the Department of Technology Management and Budget. It will be a team that will be led by a number of professionals and will be held to a high account, and actually probably the audit, and there'll be all those regular processes, procedures in place to make sure that we're using tax dollars wisely.
Raj, I'm trying to figure out a comment you made just a minute ago. Were you involved in the setup of the cyber range?
I've been involved with the state in advising them and meeting with some of the public sector, private sector companies in defining what the range should look like and how it should operate, yes.
It sounds like an awful lot of fun for somebody who is technologically inclined, was it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the best part was meeting with a number of individuals, and also it was a leading edge thing. You know, there was a lot of national interest in meeting with all the individuals from that, and just collaborating and learning and talking about the issue and how we can set up the range.
Yeah, Mark, let me just add also that the cyber range was funded as a public-private partnership. So we have a lot of private sector companies that have contributed to setting up the Michigan cyber range. We have a lot of Consumers Energy, Detroit Edison, a variety of others that have been involved in this and have provided funding and actually send their students and pay for the classes. And so it really has been that cyber range has really been a joint effort of public and private sector.
And tell us a little bit more, Dan, about the formal training on the cyber range scheduled for July. What'll be happening exactly?
Sure. We will be having an exercise that will be working with state staff and volunteers, as well as West Michigan Cyber Coalition, where there'll be an exercise in late July and attack defend type of exercise that we call a tabletop, but it's actually hands-on simulations around networks and defending networks, attacking networks. There's actually a network the Cyber Range sets up called Alphaville. They have a library, they have a utility, it's in cyberspace. This is virtual. And so there's actually opportunities to go in and see if you can attack and take over the utility or the city hall or the library and then go different places and see what would happen if that. And you can watch the simulation with avatars avatars. It's pretty cool stuff to actually see this. So the different teams honing their skills and actually improving and actually learning at the same time.
We want to thank our guests. Dan Lohrman is Michigan Chief Security Officer. Raj Patel is Information Technology Consulting Partner for Plant Moran. Both are playing a key startup role in Michigan's Cyber Civilian Corps. Raj, Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the Homeless Angels, which is a new Lansing-based organization that does outreach and referrals for people who are mostly street-based homeless. Mike Carl is the founder of the Homeless Angels, and he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to Current State, Mike.
Thank you.
Tell us more about Homeless Angels. What do you do exactly?
Well, we're a innovative street outreach to the homeless that uses the internet and social media to interact the community with the homeless community, and we call it real-time giving.
But you spend time out on the streets,
yes,
too. So this is an interesting dual approach here.
Yeah.
That's social media and the internet on one hand. Generating support for homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you go out on the streets?
We usually go out on street walks about twice a month, and sometimes we have as much as 60 people that walk with us. We make lunches, blessing bags, and go right under the bridge and build a relationship with the homeless community.
And you're seeing, and where do you go?
We right downtown, anywhere there's a need.
Your focus is on downtown Lansing?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, and what are the reactions that you get from the homeless people when you reach out to them?
Generally, very thankful. We really haven't had a bad experience. We help as many as we can, and building the relationships to connect them with the needed resources in the area is the most important focus for us.
Well, tell us a little bit more about where the social media comes in. How does that play out in the Homeless Angels?
We call it real-time giving. And we use the internet to tell stories of homeless people and families and those in need. And people can connect directly to these people and help them. Like on one of our first street walks, we had a guy that had no boots in the middle of winter. And we, within 20 minutes from someone seeing our post on the internet, they brought a brand new pair of boots to this man.
Mm. And you've only been up and running for about 6 months. Tell us about the first 6 months.
Yep. In the very beginning, it was just us out on the street walking, and community support started to build with our social media. We were featured in several different media and social media stories, and it just kept building. It's been a great community involvement project, and now we're moving to Detroit, and we'll have our first street walk in downtown Detroit next Friday.
Boy.
Yeah.
I take it for people online to get to know a homeless person in this way. Is that the real spark here? It seems like that would be the spark. The homeless are just not this population that's removed from you. This is the chance to get to know a homeless person face-to-face, get to know their name, get to know their circumstances.
Yep, and this gives us an opportunity to reintroduce the homeless community back into the community, where they're up living under a bridge and they've lost hope. We give them that little spark of hope, and we show that there's people out there that care about them and that they are important in society and that they're not invisible. And once we get past that, they want to join the programs and get involved, and a lot of them give back.
How many volunteers do you have, Mike?
Oh, anywhere from, on any project, 60 to 100. We have a really core of about 20 volunteers that are with us every day that volunteer at the office and help us on our social media and connect and help people.
How about full-time staff?
There's about five of us
full-time. Okay. And what partnerships, this is a collaborative effort, as I understand it. What partnerships have you developed with other service providers?
We work closely with the VOA, with the City Mission, the Diaper Bank here in town, where we've given about, 200 to 300 diapers away just this month, to needy families that need diapers and wipes and things like that, because it's not just the homeless community that's need. There are a large segment of society that's right on the fringe. We're all a paycheck away from homelessness.
And so it's really, you assist more than just homeless people at the Homeless Angels. We're talking with Mike Carl here on Current State's Neighbors in Action here today. Mike is the founder of the Homeless Angels, which offers outreach and referral services to mostly street-based homeless people here in the Lansing area. They've only been up and running for about 6 months, but apparently they've generated an awful lot of momentum here so far. Why did you start this group?
8 years ago, I was homeless. I didn't want to tell anyone. I was depressed. I pretty much was at rock bottom, and I went to the streets. And I lived with the homeless community for 6 months, and they kept me alive. And this gives me a way to give back and give them thanks for not giving up on me. And I want to show them that me and others aren't going to give up on them either. And we're going to give them the opportunity to reintegrate into society and become an active part of the community.
How did you become homeless?
I was divorced. I got depressed. I lost everything. The foreclosure crisis was just starting. I got way over my head, and I just slipped into just past the cracks of society, and I became invisible. And I lived in a fountain in downtown Lansing. And it took the homeless community to reach out to me to get me back on my feet.
What were those 6 months like?
It was not fun. It was the hardest thing I think I've ever faced. And just to allow the community to glimpse in through pictures and stories gives the homeless stereotype a better look over for the community.
What happened that enabled you to get out of homelessness, though? Was there a moment of truth? Was there a particular assistance that you received?
There was a pastor in downtown that I think he was from another city, came up to me and he said, "These are the services that are available to you. And this is how we can help you." And it took someone like me coming out and reaching out and asking for nothing to give me a hand up. And that's what I want to do, and others,
and that's
to the community.
Led to the foundation of the Homeless Angels here in Lansing. Are there common misperceptions or misunderstandings about people who are homeless?
Mm-hmm. There are. There are. It's that they're drunks and they're lazy and that they just want to live under a bridge. And nobody really wants to live under a bridge. I've been under a bridge, and it ain't fun.
How did you get this started? How did you launch it?
3 years ago, I started living on the streets once a week in November. And this year, it just took off. I had my co-founder, Jessup Magoon, ask me to come walk the streets with me that week. And literally everybody, I live stream it, and it just took off.
Mm. Where does your funding come from for the Homeless Angels?
It's all community-based. We use a hotel program. We allow the community to buy hotel rooms for the homeless so that we can aid them, get them to the resources that, if they're chronically homeless, give them a chance to rehab. And we also work with landlords and employees to get them jobs and get them into a more economical situation that they can better themselves and get ahead.
Did you, and I mean, 6 months ago, did you anticipate moving this operation to Detroit?
No.
No.
Yeah. No. But it's taken off, and this is the way it needs to go. I mean, the support in Detroit has been great. We met with Police Chief Craig last week when we did a free store, and they had their own event down there, and we're planning another free store in Detroit on the 7th. That's another innovative thing that we do is we bring boxes out and with clothes and personal needs, and we drop them in the city and let anyone that is in need come and get them.
We're talking with Mike Carl. Mike is the founder of the Homeless Angels here in Lansing, which offers outreach and referral services to mostly street-based homeless people in the Lansing area. It's been a busy 6 months since the formation of his group, and they are now expanding into the Detroit area. Tell us a little more about your volunteers, Mike. Why do they join you? Why are they there?
There is a huge compassion amongst Lansing that is drawing people to just help people. There's no exceptions. They don't want anything back from it. They want to do something and see results, and this gives them real-time results. They can go out on the street and walk with us, hand somebody a lunch, hand somebody a blessing bag, and see the joy in that person's face and the change that it sparks.
Was there no other organization doing this kind of work specifically?
I think there's other street walk organizations, but not like we are. We are very innovative. We use every source of media.
The social media seems like it is really the distinguishing difference here.
Yep.
Yeah. What's your ultimate vision for this organization? I mean, how much further would you like to go with this?
I would like to see it in all 50 states.
All 50, and you want to play a role in spreading it to all 50 states?
Mm-hmm.
If people want to get involved, how can they join you?
You can look for us on Facebook.com/homelessangels. You can follow us on Twitter, the same handle. You can also go to our website at homelessangels.org.
Mike Carl is the founder of the Homeless Angels. Again, they offer outreach and referral services to mostly street-based homeless people in the Lansing area. Mike, many thanks and good luck.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work, but we don't know about them. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. We have some sad news to pass along here today on Current State. Renowned author and poet Maya Angelou has died. Maya Angelou was 86 years of age. Again, Maya Angelou has died. That is our program here for today on Current State. Coming up tomorrow, we'll look at 125 years of innovation in Lansing with the folks behind the new Made in Lansing exhibit at City Hall. That and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.